Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and each week I interview military veterans about their civilian career. Today is episode number 164 with Rich Carey.
And they're like, oh, wow, you know, those are all the things that he's done. Okay, he's got 20 houses that are paid off. Like, he's rich. Like, so cool. He's, you know, he's set for life. But like that, I don't think that's really where the financial independence comes from. I think the financial independence comes from I set myself up financially, like before I started investing in real estate. I did that by paying off my mortgage, getting rid of my debt, and like living well below my means, saving and investing well. And then I think I just use real estate, you know, as a way of building wealth along the way. That's certainly not the only way I could have done it.
Well, special thanks to Doug Nordman for making the introduction to Rich. If you like this episode, I highly recommend listening to Doug's interview. It's about financial independence as well, with a lot of great advice for veterans and non-veterans on how to live a financially healthier life. My guest today, Rich, is actually currently on active duty, and the reason why I think his advice is relevant to every single listener of this show is that it's fantastic advice about living below one's means and investing in real estate or in other things to set yourself up for financial independence. We talk about values, what you value, how to save, investing, financial independence, a really nice step-by-step approach to real estate investing, as well as great resources to help you learn more about this. One quick correction at the very beginning of the introduction, I mispronounced Rich's website. It is richonmoney.com, and there is a load of information there for you if you're interested in this topic. As always, at beyonduniform.io, you'll find show notes. There are tons of websites, books, and other things that we talk about today. Links to all of those are in the show notes. Also, if you haven't had a chance to leave us a positive review on iTunes, it helps get word out about the show. I would greatly appreciate it. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Rich Carey. Well, joining me today in Osan Air Base in South Korea is Rich Carey. Rich, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Hey, thanks for having me today. Really excited to be here.
Well, I want to give a special thanks to Doug Nordman for introducing us. Doug has been a guest on the show before and has been a great advisor for me with Beyond the Uniform. Rich is currently a commander in the Air Force. He's stationed at Osan Air Base in South Korea. The reason why I'm so excited to connect with him today is that while he has been on active duty, he has not only paid off $280,000 of mortgage in 6 years, he's also paid off $32,000 in student loans in under a year, and he flips houses and purchases rental properties with cash while living overseas in the military on active duty. He currently owns 20 rental properties mortgage-free, and he operates, despite a demanding schedule and frequent travel, the website richonemoney.com. And the thing that I just really appreciate is Rich right now is joining me. It's 6 o'clock in the morning, and over in Korea. And I get the impression from what I've read about you online, Rich, this is probably not atypical. You have found a way to just pack in so much in the nooks and crannies of your schedule between your writing and rental properties and all of those things. So I'm very appreciative of your making the time to connect with me.
No, thanks a lot. Yeah, I'm happy to sort of share and talk about it with everybody. Everybody today.
Well, maybe to start things off, you talk about it on your website, but could you share with the audience a little bit more about when and how you first got started in real estate?
Okay. So I think the way to sort of summarize that is first of all, when I got into the military in 2000, I kind of had this desire to get started in real estate right away and to buy something. But like that's not always possible in the military, just kind of, you know, based on where you're sent. And the first place that me and my wife were sent was to Guam, right? And Guam's like, you know, this tiny little island out in the middle of the Pacific that a lot of Americans don't even really know where it is. I wanted to buy real estate, but Guam, like, I don't know if some people own in Guam, probably not really the best place to own real estate. And while I was there, There was, you know, three different typhoons and, you know, four or five different earthquakes. And I actually lost my entire apartment while there. Luckily, I was renting. So I ended up not buying in Guam. Next assignment was Washington, D.C. So that wasn't until 2003. Very excited to finally get there, but already 3 years into my career, I purchased a townhouse for $280,000. I knew I wanted to buy something, but I was not by no means a real estate expert. I just knew that, real estate was the thing for me. And $280,000 at the time seemed like enough money. I mean, it scared me to death. I didn't sleep at night, you know, spending that much money in a house. And I thought for sure it was the worst financial decision of my life because the market was so hot. Come to find out, after owning for about a year, that the prices had gone up from 280,000 to almost 450,000. So I thought, wow, you know, this real estate thing is amazing. I think I also had this mistaken idea in my head, like, wow, I'm like a real estate genius. This is great. This is all me. You know, I can't believe how good I am at picking houses.
It's like nothing is more dangerous than a little bit of success.
Exactly. In reality, that's just timing. And, I tried very hard to buy some more houses, and I think very luckily I didn't end up buying more because they were just shooting up so fast in price. I just couldn't find a price that was reasonable anymore. We'll probably get to this, but one of the things I did shortly after that, I moved away and I ended up having that house in Alexandria, Virginia as a rental. But one of the things I did shortly after that was I ended up flipping new construction.
When you say flipping new construction, what does that mean?
So I think everybody has probably heard about flipping houses, and that's like super common. And you see that on these TV shows where people flip houses and make money. And I think what a lot of people have not heard about, and what is much more rare, was this concept that it happens at certain times in these real estate booms, where you flip new construction. And that's something that I saw everybody else doing. And by the way, whenever you see everybody else doing something and you want to make money that way, it's actually a bad idea.
It's too late. Yep.
Yeah, I saw everybody else doing this and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm going to make money like everybody else. So what you do is you go to these areas. There's lots of new construction being built because house prices are escalating so fast. And so you go to an empty, area where they're going to build attractive new homes. And there's usually just a trailer there where they've got like a model of what the area is going to look like when it's done. And you go inside and you purchase a property that hasn't been built yet. And you make a deposit. I think the deposit was only $20,000. And then you start like picking everything out, kind of like you would if you bought a new house, because that's what it's going to be, a new house. You pick out like you get to pick out all the extras. And so I think I kind of went like all out getting like, vaulted ceilings and, crown molding and, Bose sound system and all kinds of crazy stuff in the house. And I had an end unit. I had an end unit for townhouses. And I had one of the first townhouses in the entire development, which actually is a helpful perk to have. And so you've purchased this house. You've got the price locked in, but they haven't even started building it yet. The idea is that they start building this house, they finish building it. When it's finished being built, you have to pay for it and then move in. But what ends up happening is this takes more than a year to happen. By the time it's built, supposedly it's appreciated so much in value that you don't even buy this house. You find another buyer for it. And you simply reassign it to them for a higher price, and you just keep the difference.
So for that $20,000 initial investment, you have the chance to, if things appreciate at a pretty good clip, you have a chance to walk away with a 5 to 10x return on that $20,000 investment.
That's exactly right. And the unfortunate thing is that had already worked like several times for a lot of people that I knew, and so. The fun was already over. And so I tried to do that. And in my case, it was getting It was, I think, 2005, and we were getting towards what nobody knew, but what was, you know, going to be the top of the market, and you know, the bubble was about to burst. And so the prices did not go up. They stayed about the same. And I realized that I was going to have trouble selling this house. And I tried to get it, I put it up for sale, and I also tried to get it rented out. Neither situation was going well. The only bites that I had as a rental property that would come anywhere near covering my mortgage were Section 8, people from Section 8 that were reaching out to me. And that's not something that I was very interested in. The person that wanted to rent to me that was Section 8 had, I think, a lot more children than that I was comfortable having in the rental property. But they were able to offer a lot more rent than anybody else was. And I don't know if everybody's familiar with Section 8, but that's where the government ends up, paying. It's kind of like the government ends up paying for the mortgage every month, or the rent check is sort of guaranteed by the government every month, and it's kind of a welfare program. But that program sometimes also comes along with other problems as well. And I wasn't comfortable doing that, so I said, well, I'm still going to try to sell this property. I ended up offering like a seller's bonus to the seller's agent. And I was also one of the first tracks, finished. So I was lucky enough to get this house sold and like barely break even. I even made a few thousand dollars. But what I noticed was that every single house that was finished after mine also went up for sale. And that happened for the next like 100 houses. And pretty soon, values of houses were dropping and houses were going into foreclosure. And nothing was selling, and the neighborhood actually ended up being kind of a rundown neighborhood.
Well, so if you had held on without offloading that, you still walked away with a couple thousand bucks, but you would have probably lost a lot of money had you not gotten out at that point.
Yes, and then there was I didn't know yet, but there were wider spread problems than that brewing in the real estate market. And then I went from there to moving to Monterey, California to go to Naval Postgraduate School in DLI. I still had this real estate bug. I just wanted to do something in real estate, and I was still convinced that I could somehow make money, and it would be a big part of my sort of financial portfolio to figure out real estate. And I still was riding high on like the amount of money that I made on my first property, which was just kind of sitting in equity in my property. And I got there and I was considering buying, and they were taking me around. And so, as you may know, Monterey, California, like where Carmel is, that's an expensive area. And the real estate agents were taking me around telling me that I was going to make a fortune if I bought, then, because everything was still skyrocketing, but I had to, move quickly because the market was hot. So I came very, very close to buying a 2-bedroom, 1-bath house in Monterey, California for $900,000.
Oh, man.
But that just seemed way too expensive. And I kind of got cold feet at the last second. I'm glad that I got cold feet because, house prices ended up dropping significantly over the next 2 years while I was there. Some people that bought in that area or in surrounding areas, I'm saying some military members, some friends of mine, some classmates, ended up buying and then losing almost half of their value in the time that they were there.
Wow.
To the point where they had to walk away from their houses when they PCS'd.
Wow. One thing that I like,
that's the beginning of my sort of real estate career.
Well, one of the things I like about your story is that at any one of these points, you could have walked away and stopped. I think that these are, potentially painful experiences, and you kept at it. And I imagine in that situation where you sold the house just barely for a profit, you might not have made a lot of money, but I imagine you got a lot of great experience out of that. And that because you kept at this and kept learning from it, that paved the way for your future successes, because this is part of learning something new, is making mistakes like this or near mistakes like that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think then that comes up again, certainly comes up again in my career with, I ended up flipping houses while I was in while I was overseas in Japan. I had a partner and who lived across the street from the house that I own in Alexandria, Virginia. We ended up flipping houses together, and he was sort of the partner who was in the States, and I was sort of the one arranging for the financing. And then when I had my when I bought my first rental property in Montgomery, Alabama, what you're describing definitely comes up again, where and we can get to this in a second, but where I had some sort of from my perspective, some very kind of scary things happen. And, you know, I felt like I was making a lot of mistakes as a, you know, newbie real estate investor when it came to renovating my new property and trying to get it up, you know, trying to get it rented out. And I remember my wife telling me at the time, like, man, that was a really tough experience. I guess this real estate thing isn't going to work out. And I told her, like, what are you talking about? I want to buy two more properties right now. Like, I want to keep going.
Doubling down. I love it. Yep.
Yeah.
Maybe we can start with, because you have such, so let me kind of set the stage for a couple of questions. I think that what I love about your story, and I think you share this with Doug, is you have been very savvy in building up financial resources so that when you exit the military, there's not going to be a tremendous amount of financial pressure. You'll have a fair amount of autonomy. You can take time to figure out whatever you want to do, or you could do something that's pays less money or affords less income than otherwise. And I'm thinking of those who are on active duty or people who have gotten out recently who want to follow in your footsteps. They want to have that financial freedom. And that for them may be just having 6 months of money to be able to take time in finding their first job, or it could be finding a way to be financially independent, like I imagine you will be when you get out of the military. And one component of that is paying off debt. I think that's one of the really impressive things about your stories. And I also really appreciate it. I'll add the link in the show notes for listeners. You have a great article on 9 debt payoff hacks that work. And so maybe we could start with those who are listening who have some sort of debt, be it mortgage, be it student loans. What advice you have for them for eliminating that debt, but also, like, why is that so important? Why is that one of the central pieces of your own story?
Yeah, so I think on the surface, if somebody in the military hears the plug that you gave at the beginning, and they're like, oh, wow, you know, those are all the things that he's done. Okay, he's got 20 houses that are paid off. Like, he's rich. Like, so cool. He's, you know, he's set for life. But like that, I don't think that's really where the financial independence comes from. I think the financial independence comes from, I set myself up financially, like, before I started investing in real estate. I did that by paying off my mortgage, getting rid of my debt, and like living well below my means, saving and investing well. And then I think I just use real estate, you know, as a way of building wealth along the way, but it's certainly not the only way I could have done it. And I feel like, and of course, the earlier in your career, you kind of, I think it's sort of like, it's like a mindset that some people, you know, end up sort of buying into, and some people, and then it's just kind of like, you know, I don't know if it's, I want to say an American way of thinking. Some people end up buying into this and some don't, where we spend a large amount of our incomes on things like housing and housing, cars, vacations, and I would just say things, right? Like, you know, having expensive furniture or taking, you know, buying like designer handbags for your wife or, you know, stuff like that. And I think from very early in my career, I kind of focused on those very expensive things, like living very well below my means. And I was in Monterey, California, and I think that the allowance to live there was $2,300 a month. That's how much they give you, you know, as a whatever, as a captain to live there. We rented a place for $1,300 a month, right? Mm-hmm. And then pocketed that extra $1,000 a month. That was money that I was paying off my mortgage with, you know, or saving for real estate. I think I was, you know, yeah, at that point I was, still paying off the mortgage. So, you know, there's that. And then, you know, we just kind of like never took those expensive vacations, right? We never had a new car, and I would certainly recommend against ever having a new car. And again, in the military, I think it's very common for people to have things like, you know, motorcycles or maybe boats, right? You know, maybe buy a timeshare. I can tell you these things will just kill your chance to have financial freedom someday. So I think that focusing on, like, you know, trying to live in a very reasonable way, where you're putting a lot of money away because you're not wasting a lot of money on living expenses, having like reasonable vehicles that are used vehicles that are paid off and there's no debt being acquired that way. And, you know, I'd say kind of like travel hacking to me is, you know, the military sends you to all these different places in the world. So you don't need to like put your family on a plane and fly somewhere and stay in fancy hotels to take a vacation. You can, like, you know, do so in a much cheaper way, hopping in a car, driving somewhere, staying in an Airbnb and cooking all your meals, you know, in your little apartment, as opposed to the expensive version of a vacation. I don't know. Maybe that doesn't sound real sexy, but like, that's the way. That's like the simple way that I lived my life and was able to put myself in a financial position to like have a bunch of real estate that's like all paid off, and now in a position where, you know, I'll be very, like, I'm already financially independent. And when I retire, that extra money is just, you know, that pension is just extra money in my account.
I'm going to take a guess, and I'd love your thoughts on if this is accurate or not, but I'm wondering the role that goals have played in making it easier for you to make what some would consider to be a financial sacrifice. And I'm thinking of a gentleman I interviewed recently who spent 28 years in the Army. It's in episode 159. He spent 28 years in the Army and then now owns a farm. And he, you know, for 10 or 15 years in his career, building his farm was his goal, and that made it easier for him to scrimp on everything possible, because he knew that if he saved $5,000, he could buy cattle, and if he saved another $2,000, he could buy chickens. And having that goal made it much more tangible for him to make these sacrifices. And I'm curious if that rings true for you, of like having real estate as this side pursuit made it easier to make those financial sacrifices because you knew where that money was going to go towards.
It certainly did, yeah. I mean, I think for me, I have this, like, I mean, everybody kind of will have their passion or their thing that they you know, love, and my passion is real estate, and since it's real estate, I mean, it's a funny thing, because real estate is something that can bring you financial freedom, and so for me, it was always in these numbers. Like, I have a mortgage, a $280,000 mortgage. I got this idea that it would be smart to pay that mortgage off. And you can debate that. Like, I could have kept the mortgage and, like, you know, invested that money instead. And that's something you can certainly debate. But I paid that mortgage off, and that was kind of like a goal that I had. And then when I started investing in real estate in Montgomery, Alabama, the houses there weren't very expensive. Like, you know, they're not $280,000 each. I don't own 20 houses that are worth $280,000 each. You know, the houses in Montgomery, Alabama, you know, are probably worth, you know, between, you know, $60,000 and $80,000. So, like, my goal was to, you know, how many can I own? And I want to pay them off. And so as I'm doing this, as I'm, you know, going after this goal, which requires me to make financial sacrifices, you know, requires me to not buy new cars, to not take fancy vacations, you know, to not do other things that might be very appealing to other people. And, you know, I buy 6 houses and I'm like, awesome. You know, I have this, financial stream of income and I'm accomplishing this goal. And so for me, having that as a goal certainly helped me get there.
And that one of the themes that comes through, it seems like, in your story is, Paying for something in full in cash seems to be, from, you know, an external standpoint, a theme of your story. Is that true? And why is that so important for you to pay for a car in cash or pay for something in cash?
So I'm going to try to, this is kind of it's a complicated thing to explain, because I guess I'll caveat this by saying, if you were to take real estate and put it side, you could put two different scenarios side by side. You could buy a property every year using a mortgage. It'd be better to use to have 20% down if that's possible, and invest that way. And then you could buy a property like with cash, you know, every year. If these two things were possible, if all things being equal, the ability to leverage real estate opposed to like the ability of paying cash with real estate over the long term, you know, most kind of like modeling this with a computer, in most situations, you would come out with a higher net worth using the leverage, using the mortgages. Like, that's just the way it would work, because you're able to sort of like cash flow and appreciation are kind of magnified because of the way that leverage works. When you get 3 or 4% of appreciation a year in appreciation, that gets magnified by the fact that you have a mortgage. But I guess I would also argue that the opposite is true. And when the market goes down, the fact that you have a mortgage also magnifies that problem. And so having a bunch of mortgages and then having a dip in the market can also be a big problem.
Because you could be stuck in a downturn then paying $1,000 a month on 20 different properties, which just really adds up. So now you've got $20,000 of expenses to cover every single month until they get occupied or the market rebounds.
And a lot of different things could happen. I think my portfolio is a good example. I'm in Montgomery, Alabama. So even if I didn't have a downturn, what if the military bases there closed, you know, some kind of a BRAC thing or something. And then I started having like a lot more vacancies and a lot less rent. I think if I had mortgages on those properties, that potentially could financially ruin me. Like, that could be enough of a disruption in my money coming in each month that I might not be able to make my, my mortgage obligations. And that would have a domino effect that could like take down my entire stream of income. And the fact that the properties are paid off, like, that is not a risk. I mean, if the houses, you know, went down by 20 or 30% and and there was vacancies were up a lot for a year or 2 years, like, I would just be kind of annoyed, like, oh, I'm getting like a lot less money than I used to every month. but it would not be dangerous at all, because I have no mortgage payment to make. So I don't know if that kind of illustrates what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like, tell me if this sounds about right, it's almost like your approach is the more conservative but safe approach. And while in a great economy, you may make some fraction of money less, but in a poor economy, you're not really at risk. There's never any sort of high risk situation for you.
Exactly. And I think the other thing too is I'm paying off these properties, right? And again, I don't have to do this. If I kept mortgages on them, potentially over the long term, I could make more money. And I'm also not ruling out that in the future, I may continue to buy real estate, and I may use debt to do that. But what's been in my mind as I've been paying these properties off is that I wanted the option and I wanted the peace of mind to get out of the military at the 20-year point and to go wherever I want and do whatever I want, and just to be comfortable that I had no obligations of any kind, no financial obligations of any kind. So if you kind of like know that you're going to stop working and that your primary method of income is about to end, then paying off mortgages in that case can be a very smart thing to do. I'm talking about mortgages now. Now, when it comes to paying off like cars, I feel like that's a no-brainer. I'm not a huge fan of, you know, people having like, you know, these taking out loans to get cars or taking out loans to get like anything in the world other than a mortgage. In that case, I think we're buying things potentially that we don't necessarily need. And then the interest that you're paying for that is, you know, money you're just, you know, throwing in the trash because those aren't assets, you know, that can appreciate and make you money. And if you need a loan to buy it, I would probably also argue that that means you really didn't have the money saved up in the first place, you know, so you probably shouldn't buy it. But that's just my perspective.
I love that. I think that's a great concept. Like if you do, if you have to borrow to get it, maybe rethink getting it. It's certainly not a popular idea, but it seems like that's a pretty true statement.
Well, I mean, it's just like what you value in life, right? I mean, it's funny because it's, you know, I'm trying to teach my children about money, right? And everybody has their own approach on, you know, what's important in life and what's important about money. And I always I'm trying to get these like life lessons across to my son. We just came from living 3 years in Stuttgart, Germany. And he was always like, he loved seeing the different cars there because the headquarters of Porsche and Mercedes are in Stuttgart, Germany. And he'd always be like, Dad, look, there's another Porsche. You know, Dad, what's your favorite Porsche? I'd always say like, son, what do you think is better? Like, do you think that having a Porsche or like having $150,000 in the bank, like which do you think is better? And he'd have to think about it and he'd be like, I guess having $150,000 in the bank is better. And like, that's the answer that I'm looking for, right? You know, it's, you could have a Porsche and be like kind of poor, but drive that thing around but have a bunch of debt. Or you could like have that money in the bank and drive like, you know, a reasonable used car, you know, and but have that peace of mind to know that you've got like, you know, money in the bank that you can do other things with. And that's just like a decision that you just get to make.
I love that. I read a book about a year ago that's called Happy Money. And it's written by two Harvard professors. It's the premise of is the science of happier spending. And one of the things I took away from that book is that most of the things we spend our money on don't actually impact long-term happiness. And so when they compare the happiness someone has over time from buying a brand new car versus having great experiences or peace of mind, it just doesn't carry the same weight. And I love that illustration with your son of just comparing the Porsche versus the money in the bank. And most people, I think, would lead a happier, more stress-free life choosing the money over the car in that situation.
Exactly. Yeah. That's kind of the point I'm trying to get across to him. And of course, the only reason he answers that way is because, you know, I think I've asked him like 10 or 11 times, and then the first 5 or 6 times he answered Porsche, and then I told him he was wrong. and then I explained it to him. I tried to explain it to him like, you know, well, actually, you know, yeah, I could see why you'd want a Porsche, but if you've got a Porsche, and you know, then you actually don't have any money in the bank, you know, and then you're not able to buy other things. And then he's kind of like, oh, I see what you're saying.
What about, could you just take us through for someone who's listening who wants to get into real estate, but maybe avoid some of the painful lessons you've learned along the way? How would you guide someone through planning to buy a house and actually buying their property?
Well, I think if I've got an active duty audience, there's like definitely some pointers that I want to give. And like one of the main things I want to say is one of the things that, and Doug Nordman hears this a lot because he spends a lot of time in these like Facebook real estate forums. And I know he gets this a lot. And I hear that, I see this a lot too. I think everybody in the military has heard through the grapevine or probably knows somebody or knows somebody who knows somebody that bought a house at, you know, like almost every duty station they were ever at, and then rented those out and then retired. And now they're like wealthy and they've heard this story. And so they think that's probably a good idea. And I should just buy a house everywhere I go. And then like when I leave, I just rent it out. And like everything's going to work out great. And I'm going to have like all this money when I retire and it'll be awesome. And like that almost never works. That is actually a very bad idea. And there are for every like, you know, if there's like one person that works for, then there is like 50 people that regret doing that. You end up having a lot of reluctant landlords, and there's a very important reason for that, and that is the numbers have to be right when you buy a property to live in. When you're in the military and you're going to move every 2 to 3 years, I would say every 1 to 3 years, the numbers really have to be right when you buy a property. When you buy a property, you shouldn't think like, this is a property I want to live in. You should think, this is the property I want to rent out when I leave. And so you have to have that mindset for this property before you buy it. You're looking at the numbers. You're trying to crunch the numbers in a way where, that you know, before you even move into this place, that when you leave, this property is going to make money as a rental. And I think that's the number one advice that I would give. And I could also give this advice as well. When I was in Montgomery, Alabama, I went there with no intention of buying any houses. I just didn't consider that I would end up buying houses there. And so I rented a house. And the neighborhood that I rented in was a nice neighborhood. You know, it was a gated community with a pool and everything. And you know what? You're not going to end up buying a house in a neighborhood like that and having it be a good rental. It's actually just too nice of a neighborhood, and the numbers aren't going to work. So I rented there, and but I ended up finding properties in Montgomery, Alabama, that ended up being amazing rental properties. They weren't the areas that I was living in, and they weren't the areas that others in the military were living in. They weren't horrible areas. They just weren't where military was living. But my point is, I rented in one area, but I bought houses in another area in the same city and made them rental properties, if that makes sense.
That does. What characteristics stand out to you that, like, when you're evaluating a property, how do you know that it will be a good rental property? How do you know it will rent?
So, two different ways of looking at that. One is, numbers wise, how do you know it will rent? And then there's some simple math to start that with. And then how do you know it will rent as far as, like, you know, is anyone going to want to live there? I think then you need to, I think then having a good property manager that understands the area is important. So to tackle that first, you know, I'll talk about the 1% rule, which is, you know, something that is in my blog. The 1% rule is a rule in real estate that is very important, and it's a rule that you can sort of do in your head when you're, like, starting to look at houses in an area. And the 1% rule is, if you buy a property, I would say buy a property and fix it up and get it ready to be rented out. You need to be able to rent it out for 1% of that price. And so an example of that is, buy a property for $100,000, or you could say buy it for $90,000 and fix it up for $10,000. And so $100,000 all said and done, you need to be able to rent it out for $1,000 a month. If this number, and that's 1% of $100,000, and that means that this would potentially be a decent rental property. And that's a good way to realize, like, oh, okay, this might work. Like, buying this house, you know, in this city, like, I'm PCSing to whatever, like Tennessee, this might work because this house, these houses in this area kind of meet the 1% rule. And you kind of get an idea, like, okay, this could work. And then if you happen to be PCSing to, like, you're going to, like, be in Doug Norman's neighborhood, and it's like you're going to Honolulu, right, or Waikiki, and you start looking at rental prices. And so if the house costs $900,000, right, and you check, and you see that you're going to be able to rent it out for $3,000 a month, right? Well, unfortunately, that doesn't meet the 1% rule, right? $900,000, you need to rent it out for $9,000 a month.
I love the simplicity of that. I love the just the quick way to do a gut check in any neighborhood on it. Is this a better rental play, or is it better for me to buy and purchase in this area?
Right. And I guess I would also argue, though, if you can't rent it out when you leave, I would argue that you probably shouldn't buy it either. I mean, you know, because what are you going to do when you leave, right? I would argue that if you're in the military and if it's not going to be a good rental, you shouldn't buy it. You should rent for the time that you're there. I think a lot of people are worried about this thing, like, oh, if I'm renting a property, then I'm throwing money in the trash, right? And I don't think that's true at all. And I've written an article on that that I definitely recommend people read. You know, should I rent or should I buy? When people buy a property, you know, versus rent, there's so much extra cost that goes into having a property that you own. When you have a mortgage every month, right? But on top of that mortgage, you got like a lot of other things, you know, that are on top of that as well that you've got to pay for. Plus, you got to pay for the upkeep. Plus, you got to pay for like the taxes, which can be very expensive, and like HOA fees and a bunch of other things. And then the transaction costs of buying and selling the house. And then the short time frames that military members are in properties. And then I would also argue, too, that people are kind of like, well, I don't want to throw my money away on rent for 2 or 3 years. I'd rather build equity. You've got to like look at how a mortgage is amortized, you know, the first couple of years, even like the first 5 years that you're paying off a loan. Such a large percentage of your payment is only going to the interest, and such a small amount is going to the actual, you know, paying off the actual mortgage, the principal, that you'd be surprised how little you actually pay off in 2 or 3 years of making payments. It's not very much at all. In most cases, you're much better off renting than buying, unless the 1% rule applies and it'll make sense as a rental once you leave. So that's my little spiel for, I think that's very important for people in the military to understand, and I think it's widely misunderstood.
And for listeners, I will add links to his article on the 1% rule, as well as the article on rent versus buy. And I just want to correct and apologize. When I gave the intro, I said Rich One Money, which is an awful name for a domain. His website is actually richonmoney.com, which is actually a great name. So I'll have links to that in the show notes as well. But I wanted to correct that it's richonmoney.com. What other questions commonly come up for you when you're speaking with people or when you have people on your site? I love both of these examples that you've given. I'm just curious if there's any other common topic that people tend to get wrong or tend to ask you about.
Definitely. So I'm going to go into the 50% rule next, and then I think I should probably talk through how I purchased my first property in Montgomery, Alabama, and sort of the difficulties that I ran into there. So the 50% rule, again, something that happens a lot when people buy real estate. I want to say that people, and this just happens. People, I don't want to say lie to themselves, but I want to say that they misunderstand how cash flow works when they own rental property. And a lot of people will say that they're making money when they're actually losing money. And so it's something that I want to sort of clarify. If you buy a property and you live there for a few years and then you move away and rent it out, right? So you've moved away, now you're renting it out and you have a mortgage payment, right? And your mortgage payment is, let's say is $800 a month, right? So your mortgage payment is $800 a month. And you are renting it out for $900 a month. So what you're doing is you'll tell people like, well, my mortgage payment is $800 a month, but I'm renting it out for $900 a month. So I'm cash flowing $100 a month on this property. That's a very common thing, I think, for people to explain to people. And I guess that's actually like not true. I would argue that in that case, you're probably losing several hundred dollars a month, because your rent is only covering the mortgage, but there are lots of expenses on top of that mortgage, you know, to include like, you know, repairing things, fixing things, paying all the expenses I talked about before, paying the taxes, HOA fees, insurance, like. And so the way that I explain this, though, and again, this is what sometimes makes the numbers in real estate a little bit tricky, is something called the 50% rule, which is when you get money from rent. Let's say that you get $1,000 from rent. 50% of that actually ends up going to expenses, and that's a lot more than people, you know, realize. They'd be like, "What?" And so when you you know, this whole thing about like if you're getting $1,000 a month in rent and your mortgage is $500, I think a lot of people would want to believe that that means that they're making $500 profit. And that's not the case. If your mortgage is 500, if your rent is $500 a month, according to the 50% rule, your expenses are $500 a month. So therefore you would break even. And so I think that's a very important thing to understand. And that's a conservative estimate. And like I've crunched the numbers. And the same link that explains the 1% rule also explains the 50% rule that it's going to be linked to in the notes. And I also give an example from one of my rental properties. And I think I broke it down. Again, these rules are just like rules you can do like in your head or on a napkin real quick. They're conservative. But they're just rules that you do to sort of help you realize like, well, wait a second, how much money am I really going to make with this property? And then if you decide you're going to buy a property, then you actually try to go out and get the real numbers. Well, how much is my insurance? How much is my taxes? What are the, vacancy rates in this area? And then you actually crunch all the numbers and see for real what it is. And I think, okay, maybe it isn't that. Maybe it isn't 50%. Maybe it's only 42%. But it's a lot higher than most people think, I guess, is the point that I want to make.
That's great. And another thing that I wanted to ask you about is resources that you would recommend to listeners. And I'm just curious kind of where you are getting your information, what books have been influential for you, anything that someone listening who's interested could go out and listen to a podcast, go to a conference, read a book today to kind of increase their understanding about this.
Okay, so
and I'll caveat that by saying, in addition to going to richonmoney.com.
Sorry, richonmoney.com.
I'm sorry, richonmoney.com. Yep.
Yes, so the richonmoney.com. I think one of my it's my cornerstone document is the complete guide to real estate investing. And then there's a spot in there where I kind of list what you're asking for right now, which is kind of like, what are the resources that I should use to get started? And so one of the main things that I list is I list Bigger Pockets, right? Bigger Pockets is, I guess you would say, it's like the number one real estate website in the world. And I think when I say real estate, I think I mean real estate investing website in the world. It's a website that charges you for a premium membership, but you don't necessarily have to have a premium membership. And there's a bunch of forums you can go in and you can break it down by state or by city and talk to other investors and, you make connections, but that's not necessarily what I find the most useful. I mean, you can certainly, use that part of the website. The thing that I find the most useful is their podcasts. And what I did that was very helpful to me is I just started listening to their podcasts. It's a very good way to understand all the different ways that money can be made in real estate. Because what I've described to you, like the way that I've, been making money, which is like buying these houses with cash and then just like holding them and getting real estate in, getting like an income in every month is, just like a very small portion of the many, 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 many ways that people are making money in real estate. It's also a very conservative way of doing it. A lot of people are doing it in a much more aggressive manner and trying to make money much faster than I am. But I would recommend listening to these podcasts. And there's about 260 because I think they've been doing them for 4 or 5 years now and they do them weekly. They're the best out there when it comes to real estate podcasts. So listen to those. Listen to a bunch of those. And that's one of the first places I would look. I like, as far as other websites, similar to mine, I like a website called affordanything.com, which is run by Paula Pant. And she does real estate kind of like I do. And she even tinkered around with Airbnb with her real estate. And she's also it's kind of a lifestyle website too, where she, talks about the importance of prioritizing the way you spend your money, but she has very good articles about her approach to real estate. And I like CoachCarson.com, who has, I think with a partner, he has a business in a small town where I think he went to college, and they have several kind of like multifamily units that they own as a business. And he's also been able to reach financial independence that way. He's currently, I think, in Ecuador with his family, taking a year off and just sort of like taking, I guess, what people like to call a mini retirement. But he talks a lot about, he has very good articles about how he's reached financial independence through real estate. And obviously, he's much more aggressive with using leverage, you know, with using mortgages to do so. So I like that website a lot. You know, books, I think the book that is written by Brandon Turner, I can't remember the exact name, but like basically it's the number one book on Amazon. It's kind of like the book on real estate investing, I think is the title. I'll have to Google it and check, but Brandon Turner's book on real estate, which Brandon Turner is one of the people on Bigger Pockets who does the podcast. He has one of he's written several books. He's also written a book about how to manage your properties and how to buy properties with no money down. His book, his like sort of number one Amazon bestseller book, is one of the best books out there.
I looked that up. It's called and I'll have this in the show notes as well, but it's The Book on Investing in Real Estate with No and Low Money Down. Real Life Strategies for Investing in Real Estate Using Other People's Money.
It's a long title, but yep.
I can see why it would be difficult to remember that.
It's a good book. Those are kind of some of the real, those are some of the strategies that, or some of the, I guess, resources that I think are good. I think another thing that's important too is, you know, dig into these websites, read some books, listen to some podcasts. And then I guess the other thing that's important too is financially set yourself up where you can do something like this. And I'll also caveat that I don't recommend you try a no money down strategy. It can be done. I think you can do it with a VA loan. I think you're able to buy something no money down, and we're lucky to have that luxury. I personally always think it's smarter to have some money saved up and go into it a little more well prepared. That's just me personally thinking. Now you know, you listen to the Bigger Pockets podcasts, you're going to find a string of people that were several hundred thousand dollars in debt and use real estate to drag themselves from rags to riches. But I would also argue that there's a longer list of people that ended up in much worse debt by trying to mimic those strategies. So that would just be my caveat.
I think that's great advice, because I think we often focus on the outliers of success and then assume that that's the only route there. And I think that you're right in warning people to realize that that's, you know, you might be only getting part of the story. I know that we're running short on time, but I always like to leave the last question open-ended. And that's that I really appreciate the advice you've given on living beneath one's means and all the thoughts on real estate investing, as well as just building up for financial independence in general. I wanted to give room, if there's anything we haven't covered that you want to make sure that you share with listeners, would love to hear any final words of wisdom you have.
Sure. And I think that's going to be, in the military, you're going to end up with rental properties. I mean, just like you're going to buy a house, you're going to move away, and you're going to end up being a landlord. And sometimes you're going to end up being a reluctant landlord, or you're going to decide that you want to invest. And so, you know, you're going to be a landlord for that reason. So I want to talk about property management companies, and my approach to that. And again, we talked about Doug Norman, who, I think he spends a lot of time on a Facebook page, which is full of people in the military who are complaining about how bad their tenants are and how much trouble they're having managing their properties on their own and how it's much worse than they thought it would be. And so I guess what I would say to that is, it is very important to find a good property manager when you own a property, or, you know, and when you buy a property and you're going to move away, you'll have a chance to find a property manager before you leave, and you should put some time and effort into that. And maybe you already have a you already have a property and you're trying to manage it yourself and like it just isn't going that well. I would consider trying to find a good property manager in the area that property is in, because a good property manager that knows how to do its job, you know, is worth its weight in gold. It's worth the 10 or 8% that you're paying. All of my 20 properties are being managed. And so I'm paying that money to somebody, but I use those property managers for so many things. Like they find me, you know, the contractors that actually charge less money, you know, they help me when I'm looking for new areas to buy another property. They make sure that the area I want to buy in would be a good place to, you know, buy a new property. They inspect my properties before I buy new ones. They know all the contractors in the area. You know, they know which neighborhoods are, getting bad, right? I've used them for so many things other than the traditional property manager role. And I guess I would also say this, like, how do you vet a property manager? Check references. I ask property managers for references themselves, but then once I've checked their references, I ask those references for references. And I think that's important. I like to develop references that weren't given to me by the property managers, because, you know, when the property managers give you a reference, they have a chance to cherry pick the people that they know are going to say the best thing. I like to find a way to find people who weren't picked by the property manager that will also tell me something about these property managers. And I like to also find renters, you know, people that are being, you know, I'm not talking about like the maybe another investor, but like someone who's being managed, someone who's being managed by these property managers. I like to talk to them and say, how do you like this company? Are they managing you okay? You know, do they treat you well? And I'll even call up property management companies and pose as somebody who wants to rent a property. And I like to see how easy it is to get somebody on the phone, how quickly they return calls, how quickly they return emails, you know, how their website looks, how professional they are on the phone. These are kind of things that I've done to vet property management companies. But I guess I would say I'm not a fan of trying to manage yourself, you know, especially since I'm in South Korea and the time zone differences and all that. I'm a fan of using a property management company.
This is great. And I just appreciate the level of specificity you bring to this and how you take this and really simplify it, whether that's the 1% rule, whether that's making it easy to understand how to use those property managers. And I would encourage listeners to check out Rich's website, because I think that if you've appreciated his answers and advice on the podcast, there is a whole wealth of resources on his website. So Rich, thank you very much for joining us in Korea. I think this is the furthest away I've interviewed someone today. And I think that the lessons you've shared are meaningful for veterans, regardless of which career path they choose after the military.
Hey, well, thank you. I was really, really happy to be on your show and happy to be able to speak to this large audience.
Surface. All right. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed my interview with Rich. I wanted to share a couple quick thoughts of things that stood out for me. Welcome what stood out to you as well in the show notes and the comments section on our new website. I loved, first of all, the distinction between the property that you're going to rent versus property you're going to buy. And the house that you want to live in is probably not the house that you want to purchase strictly for renting purposes. And I think that 1% rule, I'd never actually heard that, but I think that's great that, you know, trying to approach a property that if you can't cover the rent of a value of 1% of the property plus changes and all those other things, it's probably not a good investment property. I liked his thoughts on the importance of paying with cash, and I agree that while with debt leveraging, you probably have a lot more opportunity, it also introduces a significant more amount of risk into your life. And so I think it's sound advice to just try to use cash as much as possible. I love from Rich's story this thought that in the face of failure, in the face of adversity, he doubled down. And I think that you probably heard in his story several times at which he could have bailed out and just realized, okay, this is not for me, or this is not what I want to do, or let me do something else with my time and money. But because of his tenacity and resilience and doubling down and continuing to learn, I think that that's led to his success in real estate. And yeah, that's it for this week. I've got another lot of interviews. I'm doing two each week right now, Monday and Thursday. So I hope to see you on the next episode. And as always, feedback is welcome at beyondtheuniform.io. Take care and have a great week.